Welcome to the Majlis, podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University. Majlis is the Arabic word for an assembly, literally a gathering of people sitting together, and it was used for the sessions of learned scholars, philosophers, intellectuals, and artists brought together to discuss and debate. Our podcast intends to accomplish the same purpose of bringing together experts and scholars for discussion and conversation about the politics, histories, cultures of the Middle East, Islamic world, and Muslim diasporas.
You can find the Majlis on your favorite podcast site, including Spotify and Apple iTunes. Don't forget to subscribe and let us know what you think by giving us a rating.
Salam, hello, bonjour, welcome to a very special episode of both the Majlis podcast of the Muslim Society's Global Perspectives Project at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, and Guerrilla Radio, an activist companion podcast to the Guerrilla History podcast. I'm Adnan Hussein, a professor of history and director of the MSGP project. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Matt Daitch, part of the Guerrilla Radio Activist Network. Matt, it's great to have you on as a co-host today. Tell us a bit about yourself.
Thank you so much. My name is Matt Daitch. I'm a 26-year-old organizer and a political educator. I organize with Progressive International, Friends of Swazi Freedom, the National Network on Cuba, to name a few of the organizations. And also I'm a co-host with Guerrilla Radio, spin-offs of Guerrilla History. It's great to be here to talk about youth organizing, campus organizing, just ways that more people can get involved and active around support for Palestine.
Absolutely. It's a great and important topic, and I'm so much looking forward to our conversation together. It's on a topic, of course, that's familiar to listeners of both the Majlis and Guerrilla Radio, because we've dedicated episodes in the past to Palestine's solidarity struggles on university campuses and related issues of academic freedom, freedom of speech, and the IHRA definition of anti-Semitism, and so on. However, as we all know, since October 7th, Al-Aqsa flood operation and Israel's genocidal attack on Gaza and the Palestinian people, tens of millions of people around the world have been demonstrating for a ceasefire and an end to the deadly siege of Gaza. And it's become very evident in Europe, in North America, that young people especially are in solidarity with Palestine, and that university campuses have become major sites for education and activism, and also, of course, very high-profile targets for political suppression. And we've seen the banning of student groups at Columbia and university presidents being hauled before Congress to, you know, explain, you know, why they've not been even more repressive. So one campus that has been very much at the heart of organizing for Palestine and against repression, the repression that has followed, has been Syracuse University. So we're really lucky to be joined by a diverse group of students and faculty from Syracuse to talk about these issues, about their experience and the wider kinds of organizing that they, you know, they've been doing in Syracuse and the wider implications of the organizing that that they've been doing. So I just want to invite our guests to introduce themselves. And so why don't we go ahead and start with Sophie?
Yeah, absolutely. So hi, my name is Sophie Clinton. I'm a current senior at Syracuse University. A lot of, you know, I'm working on my thesis right now in Latin American genocides. And so, of course, that has to do with Operation Condor and a lot of other genocidal patterns within the contemporary Latin American project of neoliberalism. And, you know, my interest also in South Asia and the Middle East as, you know, historical atrocity sites. And so I am really excited to be here. I know a lot of voices within our movement that couldn't be here, but I'm excited to hopefully do a good job of representing those voices in a space where they are not. But I'm excited to be speaking on all of the hard work that people have been doing within our movement.
Absolutely. Welcome. And Moade, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi, thank you. So my name is Moade. Yes, I
came to the issue of Palestine through a roommate that I used to have at a different university. So I transferred to Syracuse University from the University of Illinois at Chicago. And when I was there, I was friends with and roommates with Layla Zayed. And she is one of the Palestinian student organizers who now has graduated, who works out of Chicago or kind of does her work out of Chicago. So I am a political science major. I have also studied African-American studies within the Syracuse University. And, you know, I'm a writer. I do a lot of things. But my kind of interest in Palestine started when basically I just realized what was going on, because I hadn't really known about that before Layla taught me about it. And ever since then, I have kind of started to make the intellectual connections between sort of Black, like the movement for Black lives, and also issues relating to Palestinian justice. So I also started the Instagram account Black at Q's during the 2020, not just the George Floyd protests that were happening at the time, but also Syracuse University was having its own movement called Not Again SU. And it was in kind of like the second year or the second phase of that. And there was a lot of repression from the university at the time. There was a siege tactic that was used, in which students on campus were actually starved by the university for a number of days and withheld medical supplies and other such things because they were protesting, among other things, protesting racist incidents, anti-Semitic incidents, actually, and like anti-Asian homophobic incidences on campus that were just going completely unaddressed by the university. So I started that Instagram account as a response to everything that was going on and the cultural climate of just nobody speaking out due to the fear of repression from the university. And I just kept like with it for my entire tenure at Syracuse University. And 10 years is a weird word, maybe not that, but for my entire time at Syracuse University, I just kept posting. And something really interesting to me was that I would post about Palestine the same way I would post about any other social justice issue. And I would get a severe response, a pretty significant backlash from the student body. So that was kind of my introduction to the world of Palestinian student organizing.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for that. And we also have a few faculty joining us as well. Why don't we start with Biko? Why don't you tell people about yourself?
Hello, everyone. My name is Biko Mandela-Gray. I am an associate professor of religion at Syracuse University. I teach on questions of race, religion, politics, and ethics. I just wrote a book on four Black lives that were stolen by the state of the United States, interrogating the philosophical and religious logics that made that possible. I come at this work because I was an organizer back in the day when during the Black Lives Matter era. So I was actually directly connected to the work that was happening around Sandra Bland in Waller County. And so after not simply doing that work, but thinking about critiques of oppression and colonialization, all of the violence that has been happening across the world, my perspective has been expanded throughout this. And I'm thinking about this in relation to questions of state repression, questions of philosophical logics of the subject, all these sort of other things. But I come at this stuff both weirdly having this sort of organizer background and also trying to figure this stuff out philosophically as well.
Thanks. Welcome. Carol, tell people about yourself.
Yes. Hi, everyone. And thank you both for hosting us and creating this space to share some of the activities and efforts that we've been pursuing at SU, but also well beyond that. My name is Carol Fudda. I am faculty in the English department at SU, and I'm also affiliated with some other programs, including the Women's and Gender Studies department and the Middle East Studies program. And my teaching and scholarship extends across these areas. I've been at SU for 15 years. It's just weird to say that. And, you know, and also involved throughout with activism on campus and off campus. As Moadi was saying, we've had several instances and many instances of activism on campus. And We're also happy to talk about that. I'm also a member of the newly formed FJP, Faculty for Justice in Palestine, the SU chapter, and I'm grateful to be in company with amazing colleagues and, you know, and again, thanks for having us.
You're very welcome. It's wonderful to have you here. We're looking forward to hearing a lot more about, you know, the Faculty for Palestine group that you founded. Dana, why don't you introduce yourself as our last guest?
Thank you so much for having us, Adnan. Thank you so much, Matt, for co-hosting us as well. I'm really grateful to be in the company of such amazing, committed, and brilliant folks who are doing really radical, really important, and really principled work around Palestine at SU, but also work that has national resonance all across the country and also globally. I can introduce myself by saying I'm Dana Alwan. I teach in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies at Syracuse University. I'm one of the members, core faculty members of Faculty for Palestine at SU. I do and have done this work for a long time since arriving in the U.S. as an international student. Some of this work actually was done in Canada, where Adnan and I have met in the past in relation to Solidarity for Palestinian Human Rights, where I was national chair. And some of this work has traversed the boundaries of being a student to being an adjunct faculty to being a tenured faculty. So my work has kind of shifted as my roles in the university have shifted. And some of the reasons that I do this work is that I'm trying to connect what I believe in personally and politically with the intellectual obligations that faculty have to promote and protect students and their right to free speech, to activism and organizing, and because of my intellectual and political commitment to centering Palestine and issues and drawing connections between issues of injustice around local and global contexts. So thank you again. I'm super excited to see where this conversation goes.
Thank you so much for everyone for those incredible introductions and also for just being here and sharing this space with us. Really excited for this conversation to just help answer the questions of how more people can get involved and what has already been going on and what are the lessons. The first question we have prepared is for Sophie and Moade, which is what kinds of solidarity actions and education has been taking place on campuses, including Syracuse, since the intensification of Israel's siege and the assault upon Gaza since October 7th?
I think it's important to note that like there are a lot of universities that are participating in these things in different ways. And so I think because of the like use of social media as like our generation uses it, that has kind of diffused throughout the entire United States population in this really interesting way, or like the entire United States university population. So I think a lot of the solidarity actions that have been taking place have been kind of triggering each other and triggered by each other, both internationally and like within our country. So for instance, the Syracuse University, what we recently did is that we had a like study-in. So like not quite exactly a sit-in, but where you just go and study for finals. And what we did is we put on the backs of our computers, little signs, like just very like, you know, Free Palestine type of stuff. And that was actually something that I saw from searching up other Instagram accounts of other universities. And so where I found it was the Harvard students were actually doing a similar thing, because I think campuses sometimes have similar senses of oppression. Like there's these different levels of universities, and the higher up the quote unquote level of the university is, the more willing they are to kind of listen to their donors or suppress free speech on campus. At least this is my like perception of it. And so Syracuse University and Harvard, in my opinion, have pretty similar like institutional levels. In the sense that they're both pretty willing to try to like shut down something that is on the face of it very like peaceful, very innocuous. So I saw these Harvard students and they had their caption and it was like, they can't really stop us because we're using this space appropriately, as they said to do on the handbook in this section, da da da. And I was like, oh, okay, I see the logic here. And so because of that, I kind of introduced to the group, like, why don't we try to consider this as an opportunity for not necessarily doing anything illegal or doing anything wrong or doing anything that really like goes against any rule in any book anywhere, but is a way that we can kind of draw attention to what we're trying to do without, you know, without raising too many like legal or practical objections in any practical way. I don't know if you want to continue off of that a little bit, Sophie.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a couple instances that come to mind that I do want to highlight, at least within this podcast and for those who are listening. I think there have been far too many instances on our campus and also, I mean, more, I don't want to say more extremely, but I know with what's happening at the SJP in Columbia and also at, I believe it was SUNY Purchase, there was a student who is now being considered for expulsion from the university for taking down a Zionist sign. And there's a bunch of examples across not only our state, but also our country. And so I do want to highlight a couple instances at Syracuse. First of all, the one that was first in as chronologically. And so in the end of October, we had an event that was scheduled at Syracuse University as a teach-in for, you know, the history of Palestine to create space. I think it was October 31st. And we had essentially security concerns, in quotes, that the university was highlighting in order to cancel said event, in which case they had, you know, before that had, you know, really switched events to Zoom. They had moved events around, and there was a very clear, a very clear understanding that they did not, they had no priority or no intention to continue this event. They did want to silence us. They did want to silence those who were involved in leading the teach-in. And so essentially after that, there was a rise in student involvement. I think there was a lot of students who were triggered by that, rightfully so, and really realized the extent to which the university did care about shutting it down. And so it was very interesting. I mean, there was petitions that came out of that that were calling for the firing of a professor who had been leading the teach-in or one of the leaders of the teach-in, as she had, in quote, or supposedly done some, you know, said some anti-Semitic things in her class, was calling for the genocide of Jews, things like that, that were blatantly untrue and disproven by her and also faculty of the Women's and Gender Studies Department. And so after that, we had a bunch of other instances. We had done peaceful protests, as Mwade highlighted before, that were obviously also covered by a variety of politicians and sources, news sources, media sources on campus. I know our representative, Brandon Williams, who is the representative from our district in New York and in Syracuse and Utica, had posted on his Instagram account a video of us protesting at Syracuse and essentially said something about, made some assumption, I don't remember the exact language, about terrorism and this has no place on college campuses, something along those lines. And to see that at that level was particularly frustrating, not surprising at all, because you know, Brandon Williams has a history of this and the military-industrial complex, but that was another example. And then I think most recently, and I really do think it was probably the peak of our student activism on campus, was an instance before our winter break where we were protesting peacefully, just sitting in our student center on campus, the Shine Student Center, that is, of course, created and was renovated a couple years ago and is for students by students. You know, this is a space that is dedicated to learning. This is where all of the student engagement offices are, where our student association works, all of that. And so we were sitting, we had done this for about a week until this incident happened and had done it for, I think, a week or two after until break started. But we were sitting there with our signs on our laptops. We had t-shirts, we had keffiyehs, we had, you know, signs that were not adhered to campus property. We had read, you know, I'm one of those very nitpicky people that I will read the legal jargon and the little things before I sign them. So we were reading the student handbook. We had our little things that we needed to highlight in order not to do, to not get in trouble and have the university actually have valid concerns about our movement and to not take away from that. And so we had the vice president of student engagement. Ironically, we were in the student center and he is the vice president of student engagement. And so he came over and essentially told a student that her sign with Intifada on it was a call for genocide against Jews. And we had some back and forth about that. And essentially that was one of a few students who was in the student center at that point. He harassed her, you know, was talking to her and at some point, you know, touched her personal belongings and was violating the student code of conduct and also the code of conduct that he is supposed to adhere to. And so from that, we had a bunch of students, you know, come to that place. We had, I think that was the Monday of a week, or no, that was a Thursday of a week. And so the rest of that day and also on Friday, we had a huge influx of students. And as much as that event in particular was very frustrating and very angering for students and faculty and those involved with this movement. I think it was really important for students to see that this is something that Syracuse University is very interested in, their connections to the military-industrial complex, to Lockheed Martin, to the IOF, to Israel. And of course, they have ongoing relationships with Tel Aviv, abroad programs, things like that, that a lot of other organizations have connections to. And so I think it's really important for students to see the connection to their own campus. And so I think that that in particular, and of course, the vice president came back and started harassing students in other ways. And then there is an ongoing investigation in quotes, because we don't know to what extent that is actually going to be, he's going to be held accountable for his actions. But there's an ongoing investigation into a lot of other things that he said and came back and did. So there's, of course, videos online about that. But I did want to create space for, and of course, I'm speaking so fast, so my apologies. This is something that when I get angry, I get very, very, talk very fast. But I think it's interesting to see how that kind of came to be on campus in the peak of that movement on campus, especially with all of the really, really unfortunate, frustrating and violent events against students advocating for the Palestinian cause.
Yeah. Wow. Thanks for that account of what it was like. It sounds to me like, especially the first several weeks, it was very difficult to even talk about these issues. You mentioned that the teach-in, okay, what is a university college campus for other than learning about, you know, major events going on in the world and understanding them from expertise of scholarship? It's just an educational exercise. That was also really threatening. And then it sounds like, in addition, subsequent protests and so on were subject to quite a lot of repression. What were the demands that students were making in the, you know, demonstrations or protests that you were doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually have a document up right now with our student demands that we had printed out. And so I can just fully read them aloud. So one thing that we were demanding first and foremost was investigative action, especially after this instance right before break, unveiling the financial ties with Israel and the arms manufacturers and maintaining full transparency within the SU community. Our Dianello Veterans Center was fully, I believe, at least partially funded by Lockheed Martin. And there are a lot of other connections to weapons manufacturers that are connected to providing weapons to the Palestinian genocide that is conducted by the IOF. Secondly, we wanted commitment to divestment, of course, recognizing Palestinian struggle within the SU community. Of course, the teach-in was a violation of that demand, and which is the spark for having that on this demand list. Fourth, we wanted diplomatic and economic influence for Gaza, and so essentially calling for a ceasefire and humanitarian intervention. Fifth, we wanted championing academic integrity, ensuring a supportive environment for free expression on Palestine, commit to fostering a safe environment for open dialogue on humanitarian issues, not only in Palestine, but of course, Sudan and Congo and Haiti and the Philippines. And it's, you know, that there's so many other countries in which that is applicable, but kind of opening the door for that. And then finally, and additionally, a formal apology for fostering an environment of Islamophobia, anti-Arab racism, and an over-policing of Black and Brown students and faculty. And so, of course, that list is meant to be added to, but that is the core issues that we were demanding.
Oh, wow, that's great. I'm struck immediately by the fact that you connected the particular issues that you're facing on campus in terms of the environment, the suppression of political speech, academic freedom, opportunity to learn, with the actual issues and complicity of your institution, and connecting it to the wider struggles for social justice in your communities and the interconnections between those. I'm struck by that way of connecting everything together, because so often it seems that pro-Israeli groups, pro-Zionist groups want to isolate. And what they're most threatened by these days is the fact that those solidarities and connections are being made. They want to isolate this as a unique, special question. And then they also then want to say, why are you paying so much attention to this? Why don't you care about these other things? When it's obvious you care about all those other things because they're connected to Palestine. So that's terrific. We had wanted also to, you know, just ask you about what kinds of challenges. I mean, you've alluded to some of them, but maybe you can, you know, both of you can give us a better sense of, you know, what kinds of challenges you were facing from the various sort of forces arrayed against you, you might say, fellow students, whether you felt that this was in the academic environment as well, that things were just, you know, unsatisfying and there wasn't space for learning about, you know, Palestine, about the Middle East and so on. And what about the administration? So, you know, what can you say about what those challenges were like, how your fellow students as well as, you know, the institution itself?
I can speak on this a little bit, I think. And obviously, Sophie, you probably want to add on after I'm done. But there's a lot of different incidences that kind of come to mind just immediately, because even just in the past, like, 3 months, the administration has been incredibly, like, specific with their targeting, almost to a level that has been kind of, like, alarming. So, you know, as Sophie mentioned earlier, there was a teach-in. Pretty much the administration heard about the teach-in like 24 hours before it happened, and they managed to cancel it anyway. So just really this active sense of resistance against even opening up the conversation on campus among undergrads has really been kind of prominent to me. But more so than that, like, there are a couple instances in which, like, the first time that there was a large mass protest on campus in support of Palestine and against the genocide that's been going on. It was a protest that started up by the political science buildings and then kind of went down the hill, like past the administration building, and then ended up at the Veterans Center. And what was really interesting is that we actually had someone speaking who was the son of a veteran, and he was talking about and addressing how the military-industrial complex hurts veterans. And how, just because, you know, veterans on this campus are predominantly like white men, doesn't mean that we should necessarily like think of them as separate from this moment, because this moment is one in which like people are like the war machine is really winding up, and it's really kind of like, you know, the whole imagery of like the Death Star charging up to like fire or something like that. And so he was just talking about and addressing kind of like his own experience of the military and of being associated kind of with military spaces and military communities, and how harmful that is, like, for them, as well as all of the things that are going on in Gaza and to Palestinians. And what was crazy to me about that was that the administration was very quick to send out an email being like, there was threatening language at this protest, people felt unsafe. And really just made it clear that, like, well, either they hadn't been or they had been and were lying about it. And so that to me was one of those moments where I was like, okay, like, I understand, like, that's the direction this university is going to take. It's not just going to cancel the teach-ins. It's not just going to make it difficult for us to, like, organize these things. But when we do organize these things, they're going to do every attempt that they can to paint us as either terrorists or inciting genocide or inciting violence or unsafe to the campus community. And really that point of unsafety, I think, can be underscored with something crazy that happened on a different time, which was that, so like, we have this bias reporting system now ever since the Not Again SU movement which was kind of like this anti-racist movement on Syracuse University campus. Ever since the Not Again SU movement, they've instituted this bias reporting system so that, like, if there's a bias related incident, like racial bias, homophobia, etc., like, you can report it. But that system itself has been kind of weaponized in the past couple of months, such that, like, there was a student who, I believe this, I don't know the details about the student actually, but this student apparently, like, walked into, like, a space where they had posters up about some kind of social justice thing and was just like, I feel unsafe because this is here. So, like, just the fact that you can have, like, pictures of Black people or, you know, like, information about a Palestinian event, like, that sort of thing, would be like, oh, the presence of people of color makes me feel unsafe. And that to be taken kind of like as seriously as another incident that happened on campus, which was that I personally actually walked past a poster that was up in at Shine, which is a community center kind of for students. And these students at the Chabad Center had a poster up saying something about like Israel is protecting us, like, because they're the children of light. And so really just the utilization of active, like, genocidal language, you know, the whole children of light, children of darkness thing that, like, Netanyahu has, like, publicly stated, like, on Twitter and stuff or X or whatever, like the fact that they are able to use that language, and that that may or may not have been approved by the administration, it seems like, because they were there in an official capacity, and that seems to be okay for the administration. But then just the presence of people of color is then unsafe. And like just the way in which these different things are like leveled out and like equalized and like treated as if they're the same, or even one of them like is treated as if it's worse than the other one, and the other one is inciting genocidal language against people of color, Palestinians, like that to me is really kind of terrifying. So just kind of in regards to like the administrative response to that, I think there's also a component to which like students or their families are also kind of abusing the biased report system in order to make it seem as if there are all of these hate crimes happening, basically. But then like when you actually think about what are you actually reporting, maybe some of the quote unquote hate crimes might just be like, oh, there's like a Black person here, there's a Palestinian person here, there's an Arab person here, and I feel uncomfortable. And that would be like enough for them to submit a bias report about it. And so really like it's a combination of factors, I think, of just like a campus environment that is inherently pro-Zionist, but then also an administration that is also taking an inherently like explicitly pro-Zionist stance, and then kind of everyone else falling into step with that at the same time.
And if I could add, I as you were speaking, Muade, and of course please add on to these, because I just had like literally bullet point list of things that have happened that I keep remembering, as this obviously was last semester and way too much was happening over the course of 2 months, 3 months. And so first and foremost, I think at our first larger scale protest in November, I think it was November 9th. There's probably videos online if those listening want to look it up, because it was not violent if they need evidence. And I think there was a student who was a student of color, importantly, a Black student, who was speaking in front of the administration building and called out that same day as we were protesting. There was an organized event to send care packages to the IOF. This was planned through Athletes for Israel. There were a few fraternities on campus that are particularly Zionist. I believe Hillel Chabad was a part of that, and just those organizing spaces. And so at that time, the student had called out the names of those organizations as complicit in this genocide, along with, of course, the administration. And so to have this student call out these organizations, and then later on that night, we got an email, of course, responding to this large-scale protest, and particularly that student was targeted and saying that there was a student that called out the names of organizations, and that, of course, was a threat to those organizations. And we are looking, the FBI is on this. We have talked to the FBI. They're looking into this. So threatening the FBI on students of color peacefully protesting, as, of course, Not Again SU happened not even probably 4 years ago. That was the heat of that movement. And of course, in a cyclical way, I mean, their clientele, we've said this before, their clientele, the university's clientele kind of rotates every 4 years as people graduate and come back in. And so, of course, this is something that activism comes in and goes as students are finding out over the course of their 4 years, just the complicity that the university has in a variety of atrocities. And so to see this coming back 4 years later, and to have the university put the FBI on students of color, not even 4 years after they had supposedly been so concerned about students of color protected at our university and anti-racist push for anti-racism and anti-racist education. And so to continue on my list, because there are way too many and I'll try to keep it brief, but there was after the instance with the posters at our Shrine Student Center, the second time that the vice president of student engagement came back, he brought two armed officers. And so these were two armed, I think it was Department of Public Safety officers. I don't believe it was Syracuse police, but still they had weapons on them. They had, they were, of course, two threatening individuals to see at a peaceful protest in the Shrine Student Center as the campus student engagement vice president. So here, the name student center, student engagement vice president, all of these people that are supposed to be working for the students to protect the rights of students, to protect students who are studying, to protect, students existing at this university. Then, of course, to have weapons carried by people who are trying to get us to take down posters, of course, was a threat by the administration. And after that, we had a person coming through, I think, after the incident, maybe a few hours later, as we were still, of course, sitting there in protest to see if anybody was to come back, or also just to, you know, hold on to this space and take up this space to send a message to the rest of the university. There was an officer that came through. I don't think she had any weapons on her, but somebody had bought us donuts or something. And so she was like, oh my gosh, like great, great donuts that you guys have. But she had a police camera on her. And so it was very evident that she wanted us to smile for the camera in a way that was like just absolutely psychotic. It was so strange and absolutely just really, really heinous situation to see this woman kind of coming through and want us to smile for this camera so that the university would be able to identify us easier. And so things like that, that are very, very not hidden situations in which they want to see our faces and hold us accountable for these actions. And I have a couple, like maybe two other situations, but Moana, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah, I also just wanted to add on to the point about the university calling the FBI on us, in that, like, simultaneous to the fact that, like, you know, threatening to call the FBI, using armed officers in interactions with students, these all go against policies that the university supposedly implemented after our Not Again SU movement. So, you know, in direct violation of their own supposed, like, code of conduct for dealing with students now. But also, more importantly than that, it's not just that the FBI has been threatened to be used against us. It's also that members of our local JVP have reported that the FBI has directly contacted them, directly knocked on their door, directly talked to them, and asked them for a list of names, Palestinian names in the community. So this is not just an issue that like affects us as students. This is like more of like a canary in the coal mine sort of situation to see this is how Palestinians are being treated within the United States at this moment in time.
And yeah, I think it's interesting as well, and super unfortunate, obviously, that there are a handful of Jewish students. I mean, Jewish Voices for Peace, of course, in Syracuse has a chapter. And there are Jewish students within the university that I have personally spoken to within the movement that have been absolutely ostracized from organizations like Hillel. I know one student in particular sent a letter to the director of Hillel and administrators that were in charge of, you know, leadership of Hillel, and essentially said, you know, I don't feel comfortable in this space anymore. Weaponizing my religion and the things that I love and the people that I love against a people that is indigenous to this space, you know, using us as an excuse and our religion as an excuse to commit genocide, et cetera, et cetera. And the director had contacted her and said, you know, can we meet or something like that. Actually, it was really interesting to kind of see just all of the ways in which Jewish students have become so unfortunately, obviously really uncomfortable in this campus space. Additionally, there are like three other examples, but there have been, of course, things planned, more teach-ins. The architecture students have an organization that they've created, Architecture Students for Liberation, something along those lines. And they have noticed, along with a bunch of other students on campus, that as more planning is going on and more contact with campus faculty and staff goes on, not obviously the Faculty for Justice in Palestine, but faculty that are outside of that, they see the rewriting of policies. And so as soon as they'll email somebody about a space, they'll be like, oh, you know, unfortunately, you know, this, that, or the other thing, there's this policy in place. And when they ask for evidence of that policy, there is nothing. There is, you know, no response, and or they aren't able to come up with a paper trail to support that claim. And so in addition to that, of course, you know, with bias reporting that Milane brought up, it's really interesting to see who is comfortable reporting within this campus institution, and to see the fact that there are white students in particular and students who are, of course, offended by social justice posters posted. And I think we had people posting zines across campus with like numbers straight up, just like martyr numbers, death toll numbers, who's displaced, things like that. And I've seen a variety of those across our campus. And to see that people are offended by that and that their voices, they are the ones who are comfortable going to these bias report meetings, because I've spoken, of course, to other students who, after Not Again SU, this was implemented, and people who were particularly impacted by Not Again SU, of course, students of color in this space, don't feel as comfortable reporting and or meeting with faculty after, or, you know, staff after reporting this. And so that's, you know, further institutionalized prioritizing of certain voices over others. And at the same time, we had an academic freedom meeting a few months ago, I believe, where our provost, Gretchen Ritter, had essentially made a few really problematic statements, but amongst all of them, there was a student, or a few students of color, and also a faculty of color, who made a couple points about, you know, we don't feel safe at this university. Our, you know, in your phrasing of all of these FBI threats, we are being framed as the threat to this university. We are being framed as those who are, you know, bringing trouble to this university. And At the same time, I think there was a student who brought up the bias reports, and there have been a few instances where the Department of Public Safety was called, and then, you know, things were ignored. People went into their office. They were instantly ignored and kind of shooed away. And they brought that up to Gretchen Ritter, our provost, and she essentially said, that has never happened. We prioritize every single report that we get. And at the same time, you know, a faculty of color essentially said, what do you say to, you know, all of these students of color are saying that they feel threatened by the institution. They deserve an apology. And she said something along the lines of, and there's audio evidence to this, that she will not apologize for prioritizing the security of students and the safety of students. And so essentially in that, if you read between the lines, she's saying that security is prioritized over academic freedom, over the safety of students of color specifically. And that, I think, is the most representative of who she is and who the university admin is as an organization. And so among that list is are a lot of things. And there's, of course, more, unfortunately. But Moana, did you have anything that you wanted to add to that? I know that's kind of a long list of things.
I don't have anything in particular to add to that.
Thank you so much for sharing all of those different encounters and instances. I think that you really, like, it really shows over and over and over again that your any institution or organization or even individual can't take a Zionist position or a pro-Zionist position without wielding some form of racism and taking a position that is lockstep with empire and imperialism. And so I feel like just to speak very quickly, like, I'm Jewish. I've only experienced anti-Semitism over the last few months from other Jewish people who are taking pro-Zionist positions, right? At the protests we organized in South Florida to protest Elbit Systems' local office, we had a Jewish comrade arrested very quickly in the protest, right? And so, yeah. But in that regard, like, I've been to so many protests in South Florida. We did marches for abortion rights. We did marches against gun violence, marches for Black Lives. The Black Lives protest was met with tear gas. That was one of the only protests I went to in South Florida that was met with police violence. The other one was for Palestine, right? It was within seconds of the protest starting, our lead organizer was arrested, seconds, like, doing nothing out of the ordinary. And so you're describing a level of state repression and ruling class collaboration that is, like, at the highest level of any issue, right? Like, when it comes to suppressing pro-Palestinian organizing, it's at a different level, right? It's so out in the open, it's so blatant. And so there's a ton of people who are seeing this, right? And there's going to be people listening to this. And so it's about what do you want people who are asking themselves, wherever they are in the country, in the US or Canada, on college campuses or anywhere where they happen to be, what kind of political emulation do you want people to be taking from the organizing experience that you guys have gone through, or just other things that you've been seeing from other people in the space?
I think, kind of in a similar vein to what you just described, I have also recently had a friend who went to a protest in New Jersey, and the organizer was arrested within seconds of the protest starting. Like, it hadn't even, you know, nothing had happened. So they obviously knew who this person was beforehand and had kind of, like, prior planned that. So I think really just the lesson to take from that is that state repression is here. State repression will happen. You need to be prepared for that, and you need to have a plan, and just go do it anyway.
Absolutely. And I think that that's something that we've been working on. I mean, there's organizations across campus and students coming together. And I think there's so many plans in place now that we know that the university can do these things and will do these things. And this is the narrative that they're trying to spread, that we are the threat, and that students of color specifically on this campus that are speaking up are the threat. And that this has, of course, been something that has existed since Not Again SU, and they clearly have not learned their lesson or from their mistakes that they've made deliberately in the past, obviously not just mistakes, but very intentional violence against students, specifically students of color and Palestinian students in this situation. But I think it's interesting to see, you know, especially and unfortunately in that instance where that vice president of student engagement was harassing and surveilling us and taking pictures of us on his personal cell phone. It was really interesting to see the ways in which students in that space, because it is, of course, the student center, there were students who were coming up to us after and engaging with us and saying, that was really crazy. Oh, my goodness. You know, we had the student association. It was finals week. The student association had organized. So essentially our student center, you know, we have, there's this little circle and we're kind of on the ground level. And then there's the first floor and there's kind of an opening in that circle. So students can look down into the space where students are studying, and around that circle the second level circle, there was the student association had organized food for finals. And so there was an audience for their little stunt that they pulled, of course, for the vice president of student engagement when he was harassing and yelling at us. There was an audience for that. And so students who observed that and students who were also studying and saw that happening were beginning to become more engaged in this movement and join group chats and started speaking with other people and kind of networking within the movement, which unfortunate circumstances, but also really important that I think people see that there are people at this university who will not be silenced. And I think, especially at the beginning, there are so many organizations on this campus that are, you know, there are a lot of students who are very concerned within those spaces, within spaces of a lot of different organizations on campus. And as soon as students outside of that organization, because of course there are, you know, ways in which they have to, you know, get funded by the university. And, you know, if students outside of that organizations are speaking up, then they feel comfortable as individual students to come out and speak against this. So I think it's been really interesting to see the ways in which the organizations and the movement at Syracuse specifically has grown as more students feel comfortable kind of speaking out. And I also owe that to a lot of the faculty for kind of, I've noticed a lot more this semester in particular, you know, faculty feeling comfortable speaking about this in classes and kind of bringing the Nakba curriculum into their classroom and speaking on the history of Palestine and the Palestinian cause and struggle. And so it's been really incredible to see the university grow from this. Of course, the admin are not included in that, but individuals at the university kind of grow and out of this really atrocious struggle of, I guess, oppression and repression at the university.
And yeah, just to kind of like one more bouncing off of that, I really think that it's essential for all of us to remember that liberation is incredibly popular just as a topic at all times. But right now, especially, like, what is the statistics are saying, like 66% of Republicans support a free Palestine, something crazy like that. Like, the fact is that, like, the senators can try to pressure our schools and they have, and they will continue to. The FBI can try to do whatever, you know, like our administrators can try to do whatever, and the donors can try to, you know, threaten to revoke people's scholarships or whatever. But at the end of the day, it is an incredibly popular position and do it anyway.
Well, speaking of faculty and, you know, their engagement with these issues from the teach-in and beyond in curriculum, I'd love to hear more about how Faculty for Palestine has come together and what sorts of barriers and obstacles you've been confronting in trying to support students and their activism and also in, you know, having the freedom to teach about race, about settler colonialism, about, you know, these kinds of topics of which you are, you know, experts and how the university has responded to and dealt with that. So, Dana, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about Faculty for Palestine. And we could hear from Biko and Carol as well on the experience of faculty in solidarity and support with Palestine and with their students who are being active and facing campus repression.
Yeah, thank you, Adnan, for asking us this question. And thanks so much for Sophie and Moadi for giving the context from the point of view of students. We really appreciate it. I will try to make my comments brief so that my colleagues can also comment on some of these really important questions and issues that have been raised from their perspectives. So I think in response to the question regarding Faculty for Palestine at SU, Faculty for Palestine at SU is a chapter of that was formed in response to a national call to form Faculty for Palestine chapters across universities in the U.S. In some ways, it emulates the Faculty for Palestine model that was adopted in Canada many years ago. So the kind of travels of solidarity, campus solidarity between Canada and the U.S. is really obvious in the national call. I believe that there are over 80 campuses, but Carol can correct me right now on how many campuses have formed Faculty for Palestine chapters. So this is really very impressive that in a very short period of time, faculty were able to mobilize and the national call was met and heard and answered. So that's kind of the background. But of course, like the formation of these chapters rests on the fact that people were actually already organizing and doing really important groundwork that facilitated us coming together. to make Faculty for Palestine possible. Another thing to really also remember is that many of us were doing work on Palestine. We had been involved in Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Call. We had been doing scholarship, scholarly and intellectual work surrounding Palestine, but we were also actively engaged in solidarity struggles across university campuses. So we were already making connections between histories of settler colonialism, fighting anti-Blackness, thinking about the connections, local and global, between anti-war and anti-militarization, and also abolition, feminist abolition politics. So this is who and what has come together in order to make Faculty for Palestine possible nationally, but also in the local chapters. There is more that I want to say, but I think I'll pause here and see where my colleagues take the conversation, and perhaps we can continue.
Oh, yeah. No, thank you. I'll just add briefly, you know, the how we came together, you know, as Dana said, to heed the call and answer the call for national formations on the national level for formations of FJP chapters. And so we were very quick in forming the chapter, just because, you know, we were already in communication with each other. We were already working alongside each other. Also, in light of a longer history on campus of activism around issues of Palestine and racial inequity and fight for justice, and with that, also what I would add is that this coming together was also and is important for us to attend to campus oppression, but also to push against this oppression as a form of diverting our attention from what is actually happening on the ground in Palestine, as we watch people being martyred, killed, bombed, and as we are seeing bodies pulled or not pulled from under the rubble, right? So we are attending to how these mechanisms of oppression, suppression, silencing on campus are really modes of diverting the conversation away from what is happening on the ground. So that has been like a major impulse behind our actions, our responses, our pushback, in order to also highlight and lay bare how the administration, whether on campus or across the nation, because they're all drawing from the same playbook of the same discourse, mobilizing and weaponizing issues of safety and security, and, you know, to push back against this controlling of the narrative, which is what it is, and the diversion that control brings about.
So I end up playing in stories, and so I'll try to make this story as brief as possible. Both Moire and Sophie articulated a protest that happened, I believe, it was November 9th, this is the university provost, as they noted, call, like, send an email out more or less targeting folks. And so I get a phone call, probably the weekend after. Dana, you can correct me if I'm wrong. I get a phone call like, hey, we did some stuff earlier. It might be time for us to go to work. And so I get this phone call and I say, okay, you know, I've been here in a very different context before, but everything that my studies were articulating had everything to do with the fact that when a state justifies violence and death against massive amounts of people, you cannot simply sit in the ivory tower and theorize and philosophize those things away. That theoretical work is important, and it informs the way that we move, right? I want to be clear about that. I wouldn't be doing the work that I do if it wasn't for France Fanon and Angela Davis and folks like Nat Turner here in the United States, right? I want to say that very, very, very clearly. But I bring that up just to say I got the phone call and we said, okay. And I said, let's see what we can do. I found out there was this national movement for the Faculty for Justice for Palestine. And I said, sign me up. Let's figure out what we can do. And we began organizing almost immediately after that, trying to get a sense of like who gauging not simply interest, but commitment. And so I think the main thing that we have to really consider as we think about this moving forward, and I think Dana actually articulated very powerfully, and I will end on this, is we've had, and Carol reinforced this just now, I'll reinforce two things. I'm just literally repeating what they're saying, but I think it needs to be reinforced. In the span of about 3 or 4 months, over 80 chapters have been built. That says something. Over 80 chapters across the country have been built. That says something. That's number one. And number two, almost every one of the communications that we are having are, on the one hand, making sure that we're doing what we're doing, as Steve Biko used to do, on university campuses, doing that organizing locally, but with an eye always toward what's actually happening and the lives that are being stolen, robbed, and the deaths that are being stolen and robbed, by which I mean we cannot grieve them. And so how do we begin to think through, and how do we continue to do the work of centering what's happening in Gaza, in Palestine, in Gaza and the West Bank right now? And I think we're working towards that. The letter that we wrote, I'm going to pass it back to you, Adnan, the letter that we co-drafted was our first attempt to make a national push and to signal that organizing work.
Yeah, I really want to talk about that letter and also lessons, you know, for other, you know, 80 is fantastic, but let's make it 1,000, right? So I do want to come back to that. But just to pick up on a couple of things all of you, you know, were mentioning that responded to the stories of and analysis of the students of their experiences, that it's very clear that as Carol said, that they want us to be talking about these issues rather than what's actually happening in Gaza. So it's almost, you know, and here we are talking about it, but we have to, because we got to figure out strategies for how we can short circuit the kind of modes of distraction that we've been dealing with, whether it's people who want to talk about, you know, is it genocide or not? Yeah, I remember, you know, for the first month or so, there was so much debate about these ridiculous terminology. There are war crimes happening, or if you don't want to call it war crimes, there's killing happening. That's illegitimate. And we were finding ourselves in these, you know, cul-de-sacs of conversation and intellectual discourse when, you know, there's a huge moral crisis that we have to confront. So I think that's a very important point. And part of why we want to talk about what's been going on here is, how do you short circuit and get, you know, get around that? The other kind of key point, you know, was a lot about how the neoliberal academy, you know, makes us so vulnerable to these external pressures of funding and manipulation. And, you know, from what we've heard, the vision of campuses as this kind of left-wing, you know, kind of world, it's exactly the opposite. You know, this is what has to be emphasized. And so we have a struggle ahead. So, you know, what else can you tell us about, you know, what Faculty for Palestine is demanding, what you put in your letter as an articulation of this kind of analysis that can move, you know, move this movement, you know, forward into, you know, being effective?
I mean, I can start us off with just a few thoughts, but they're not very organized. I think it is important, like Carol said, to like heed like how, you know, these wranglings, these discursive wranglings over whether Intifada is genocide, whether From the River to the Sea is allowed or not allowed, whether the word Palestine with a P is allowed or not, like all these things, all these games, all these discursive political games that they're playing. It's really important that we realize that they're mechanisms of distraction, that they're attempts to get us to get into the mud with them and wrangle over, what do these words mean? Can we use them? Can we not use them? Can we look at the policy, check if the policy allows, permits their use? So I think that it is important to keep our eyes on the fact that a genocide is taking place. Over 25,000 people have been murdered. Many are under the rubble, as Carol has said. And it is also simultaneously important, not as equally, but simultaneously important, to refuse to allow administrators to take control of our intellectual responsibility to be able to utilize words, to speak up words, to define what words mean, and to actually do that in an intellectual and open inquiry method and way. Because I think that what they are doing is actually trying to control the conversation, but what they are doing is they're trying to marginalize our experience and expertise, and they're actually trying to publicly shame and gaslight us because we dare to say what is obvious to the world at large. So I think that that's one thing, like the trick between holding them accountable and making clear in public what they are doing, and also keeping sight of the fact that this genocide still is ongoing, it has not ended. That Israeli violence continues unabated, not just in Gaza, but all through Palestine, that in fact the scenes of war are expanding and that the U.S. is now actively involved, just as we saw in relation to Yemen. So again, I think our job is actually to refuse this delusion or illusion of the comfort of distance, to refuse students the comfort of thinking that what's happening over there does not matter over here, or that we're not imbricated in it. I think that that is a very central role of our obligation and role as faculty who are committed to shedding light on forms of injustice. I do think vis-a-vis what the students have talked about, that faculty also have an additional role, in fact, responsibility towards ensuring that students have the right to practice free speech, to speak, to actually receive an education that is critical, an education that allows them to study the facts and understand what is happening, and an education that doesn't gaslight them and or repeat dominant discourses regarding what is happening in the world at large. So there's many ways that we can think about the role that faculty can and should play. And I think that we have to kind of recognize that faculty have a number of responsibilities, including making responsibilities and continuing to agitate with and against admin and administrative repression, because especially we have, most of us will have long kind of affiliations with the university that will sometimes require multiple modalities of intervention and multiple sites of also conversation or lack of conversation with the university. So these are just some thoughts about how we might want to engage and think about the role of faculty.
If I can hop in here real quick, I'll say just a couple of things. You all hopefully will forgive me. We have like we're juggling 30 million things as we're in the middle of faculty organizing. So certain details over time get lost. But what I can say here in terms of specific demands is that they were split out in more or less three different areas. And this might be something for our listeners. One, the budget. What are you investing in? One of the demands that we made, I believe, if I can't remember the specific language, was raising questions around, as the students have been talking about, certain levels of investment, right? So I believe that was one of them. The other one was about who are you propping up as experts? One of the central key issues of a neoliberal institution is that when conflicts arise, they will hire people from the outside to produce a narrative that props up the state via a town hall meeting or a let's have a conversation. You all know what I'm talking about. Some celebrity that gets paid a ridiculous amount of money to more or less make the institution, which is an ISA in Louis Althusser's language, if you know what that is, we can talk about that later, but more or less to bring in these sort of quote-unquote experts outside of the particular institution to present a narrative that allows for the institution to continue to do its nasty work. And so one of the things that we are interested in terms of specific demands is saying, you already have experts on campus and you need to make sure you prop them up, because those are the folks who are actually doing the work and can give you a straightforward understanding of this without that agenda that is attached to it. These are two crucial things that we had. And number three was a critique of the weaponization of safety. One of the things that we have noticed throughout everything that I am paying attention to across the country in terms of universities is they are concerned about student safety. And as the students have articulated very, very, very clearly, whose safety? That becomes always the question, number one. And number two, how do we understand and define safety? Because if you call cops on Black folks, that doesn't bring us safety. That doesn't register to me as something safe. Right? You understand what I'm saying? And so this discourse of safety, which actually turns out to be a cover or a euphemism for surveillance, right, which is ultimately what's going down, we have to criticize that. And so many of the demands that we were saying, like, if you're going to do this work, you're going to make these claims, you need to stop weaponizing safety to be an object or a tool of surveillance, particularly against Black and brown communities. And it's in this particular case, specifically students that are both advocating for and from Palestine, right? So I think, and faculty members for that matter, right? And I want to be very, very, very clear about that. So I bring that up just to say those were some of the sort of concrete areas of demands. I can't remember the specific language around the demands, but those were the concrete areas of demands that we were thinking through and really deeply considering. And I'll say this last piece about strategy. This is where things get really tricky and actually quite boring for folks, because strategy has to be worked out in collectivities. What works at Syracuse, New York may not necessarily work at Columbia, right? Like what works in one U, but that doesn't mean that we don't think strategy. That's where I think political education comes in, where I think some of the theoretical work that we're doing comes in. I think all of that allows for that conversation. I hope I didn't speak too long. I was just trying to lay out those demands and to respond to your question.
No, that was great. Go ahead, Carol.
Yeah, I'll just jump in here with and follow up on a couple of points that Dana and Biko mentioned. So the first one, which I think is super important, even we see it in the way the language is constructed in reference to how the admin referred to the Middle East conflict, right? So from the get-go, how that is framed and presented presents this issue as something is happening, you know, over there that is not, does not have an immediate effect on our lives or campuses. We will address it, and but it's a Middle East conflict. So the first thing that we need to do as faculty, as students, as you know, folks on this campus and beyond, is to refute these divisions, because this is actually not an international or policy issue. This is a national concern. This is something that we, whether we are from the region or not, we're all affected by this, no matter where we are. So we kind of need to push against this idea of the division, the binaries of here and there, where, you know, this is concerning us all, and silence about it and staying on the fence because we're not sure, that's complicity. And so to call it as that and refute that. And the second point I want to address is this issue of expertise. And this is pertaining to faculty. So we bring in expertise that we see has been sidelined and erased and not acknowledged by admin, because, again, as I said earlier, there's an investment in controlling the narrative, and there's an investment in the admin controlling the narrative. And how we've seen that played out is an investment in dialogue is one way, and also two-sidedness, right? Like this investment in two-sidedness is also what we need to refute and push against, because it empties out any acknowledgement of power and power differentials and how that plays out in this discourse, but also how it plays out on the ground. So that's another area that we push against, because actually, why are we here and why are we doing what we do if we're not addressing issues of power and power structures and how that plays out into material and discursive frameworks? So that's, you know, that's another way that we keep pushing as faculty.
I think that's so important to have that question of expertise. I mean, you know, they're supposed to believe in the value of the education they provide and the training that, you know, the whole institution is based on. And yet when it comes to actually relying on that, they dismiss it so easily. And I think it's an important point about the fact that, you know, they only move to the both-sidedness. You know, if you look at the situation, the first several weeks, there was only one side, right, that was going to be. Then activism only gets you a both-sidedness when, of course, what we need to insist upon is expertise matters. There is a reality out there, and it has to be confronted and dealt with. So, you know, that's such an important point. And the other point that you made, and this is something that has concerned me a little bit about the discourse here of the weaponization of security, safety, the way it's been deployed to suppress political speech and organizing, and the search for genuine, you know, truth about this, is it's also very much like the privileging of some people's security over the rights of others, that is modeling exactly the conflict that we see taking place in the suppression of Palestinian rights and human rights, is that Israelis' security trumps absolutely every other value. And, you know, this is what's allowed the violence to continue and the destruction to be at such levels. And so, you know, when people say, and I guess what we're coming to here is the question of why this kind of concern about the campus and university politics matters. Sometimes it seems like, well, it's just engaged in this kind of narrow institutional frame, when in reality, what we've been talking about here is very homologous and analogous to the dynamics of power that are taking place in Gaza, in Palestine now as well. So these are all connected, and it seems that part of the investment is that, you know, these spaces are very important. The university is one of the only contested spaces that still exist in neoliberal society where you can talk about these issues. The media is, of course, corporate media. Politics is completely, you know, bought off. So it's very important that it's still a live struggle. And that's what we've been seeing over the last few months, is that this is a struggle and it really matters and is important. I don't know if I went on there. You inspired me with your points. I'm supposed to be just asking you the question. So I want to return and in conclusion, as we wind down our conversation, about, you know, any kind of final thoughts you have that you would take from this experience and what you want others to take up and take away from the experience here in Syracuse, and maybe some information. There have been a lot of, you know, new Faculty for Palestine groups forming, but if there are people who are listening to this podcast who want to know how they can also establish a Palestine solidarity organization among in the student body on their campus or among faculty, how should they go about doing that? What kinds of resources should they turn to, and what kinds of issues should they keep in mind?
Just one thing. I mean, I'm not one to, I did not organize the FJP, so I will absolutely let these guys talk about what that looks like. But I think one thing that Wade and I and some of the other folks involved in the movement is, I think, navigating exactly what to do in situations. I think there's a lot of times when there are certain things that we in the U.S. very much want to do for Palestinian liberation. And then, you know, when you listen to those on the ground in Gaza right now, especially, you know, the journalists that are still alive, of course, there are so many that have their lives have been absolutely stolen, or they've gone through some really, really terrible things. All of them have, of course. But it's really interesting to, you know, follow them on Instagram and all of the other media sites that exist, and understand exactly what they see and what they want those outside to do, because it's obviously really important to center those voices. And so I think it's been really interesting to kind of have conversations, of course, of strategy and of logistics, but of course, obviously centering those voices and kind of, you know, navigating what exactly needs to be done, rather than, you know, what we see as, of course, we have this one small community in Syracuse, New York, that is fighting for this liberation and this cause. But of course, it's really important to center, you know, this humanitarian crisis, this genocide that's happening. And so really trying to balance and understand the importance of talking about the greater issue and not just, you know, the petty little disgusting things that our administration is doing, because of course that's important, but really navigating exactly how to center the really important voices in this movement.
Do you mind if I respond to that really quickly? Thank you. Sorry, I just wasn't sure. Anyway, yeah, I think another thing that's important in doing anything like this is to remember that, kind of as Carol said earlier, this is not an issue of, oh, they're a world away and we're here. There very much is pretty much any group of people in the world within the United States. So there are Palestinians who go to every school, pretty much like every city that they live in. And it is important to kind of, I think, as a member of any movement, recognize the positionality that you're coming to the situation with, and just remind yourself, like, okay, like, for instance, I am a Black American, but I'm still an American, you know? So I think recognizing the ways in which you have things like about your identity that blind you to the experiences of other people and blind you to kind of like what might be more important right now, it like in the general scheme of things, like in the world, it's really easy to like accidentally forget, or perhaps intentionally not want to reckon with the fact that like you have it easier than somebody else, and that might make you less informed on like what is the best action to take. But just, I think that's why it's really important to form in-person, not online, communities. And I think a lot of people in my generation do forget that, because a lot of our, you know, like I have most of my friends growing up were online, you know, or something like that. But, you know, people in person can kind of check you and remind you of things that are actually more important in a way that people online can't always, because of the just capacity to disconnect. And I think that's actually one of the most essential things that you can do, because I just know me and Sophie were not the best initiators of like the movement that we have been a part of. We have been very much following other people who were more experienced and learning as we go. And I think it's really important to remember that, like, just because you are finding yourself within a positionality like of feeling good about yourself, feeling important doesn't mean you are. And so just remembering that, I think, is really, really important, like for any sort of movement, but especially when lots of people are dying.
Yeah, I think you said it perfectly. And like the message of, like, we talk a lot about accountability or holding people accountable, and that's only possible with the organization community, right? Which is something we have to build every day. And I just really appreciate every single one of you for being on this and for sharing your stories and your expertise and being involved in the struggle and the movement to not only free Palestine, but build a better world. And so I just want to end my part with this quote, this George Jackson quote that has been relevant for too long, but it feels really apt now as we're in the midst of this. And to remind ourselves that we're in the midst of this, it's been 110 plus days of bombardment, but the genocide and the occupation has been going on for much longer and will continue to go on until enough people get involved and struggle to end it. So, and that also this doesn't happen, this genocide doesn't happen without the full endorsement and support of the United States. So as we struggle in the belly of the beast, we are in the beast, and we can do a lot of things internally that make the beast unable to thrash about as much, right? So the George Jackson quote is, we have to settle your quarrels, come together, understand the reality of our situation, understand that fascism is already here, that people are already dying who could be saved, that generations more will live poor, butchered, half lives if you fail to act. Do what must be done. Discover your humanity and your love and revolution. So thank you so much.
That's brilliant. Thanks so much, Matt. It's been a pleasure having you on as a co-host. And I want to add my thanks to all of you for taking the time and trouble, Sophie, Moade, Biko, Carol, and Dana, but more than the time that you've taken to spend with us talking about what you've been doing today is what you've been doing. And I want to thank you for the important work, for providing a model, an inspiration to others to express their solidarity in an organized and concerted fashion for the people of Palestine. And so we will put links to Faculty for Palestine so that people can learn about how to organize, and of course also for Students for Justice in Palestine as well. And again, I want to thank you so much for joining us on this special episode of The Majlis and Guerrilla Radio. Until next time, salam, peace, and solidarity.
Thank you for joining us in The Majlis, a podcast by MSGP. Muslim Society's Global Perspectives, or MSGP, is an initiative at Queen's University dedicated to connecting the complex history of Islamic societies with the contemporary world. You can connect, learn more, and support us by checking out our website, www.queensu.ca/MSGP, and stay up to date with our events by following us on Twitter at MSGPQU and on our Facebook, MSGPQU. You can also follow our YouTube channel, The Majlis.